Welcome to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. This program is the second in our two-part conversation with Professor Steve Jones from the Genetics Department at the University College in London, England. Professor Jones is the author of Darwin's Ghost, The Origin of the Species Updated, a sequel to The Origin of the Species written by Charles Darwin. In this book, Jones presents many facts which are available now, but were unknown when Darwin presented his theory of evolution and thus unavailable to validate the Darwin theory of evolution. Darwin, however, was very cautious about applying his theory to humans in 1859 when The Origin of the Species was first published. I spoke with Professor Steve Jones in May 2000 by phone when he was in California. To begin this second conversation in this two-part series on understanding genetics, I asked Professor Jones what Darwin said about evolution in relation to humans at that time.
Darwin was very cautious in 1859 when he wrote The Origin of Species, and because he only came up with, there's only one sentence, which is a very, very cunning one. It says, "Light will be cast upon man and his origins." That's all he says in The Origin of Species. But he knew full well that his theory of descent with modification, the theory of evolution, applied to ourselves. And in fact, in 1871, a number of years, 12 years later, he wrote a whole book about human evolution. Now, that very quickly got into the public consciousness, caused an uproar, the idea that we were just animals. And it got so much into the consciousness that Gilbert and Sullivan, who wrote the Mikado and many other little operators as well, they have a great line which I like, which is in one of their operators, somebody sings, "Darwinian man, though well-behaved, is really but a monkey shaved." Which is kind of a funny line, but now, of course, we know that's true, because if we look at human genes and monkey or at least ape genes, it turns out that we really are shaved monkeys or shaved apes. We share about 99% of our DNA with chimpanzees, for example.
But interestingly enough, we don't share enough DNA to be able to crossbreed with them.
Well, has anybody tried, you know? Does anybody out there fancy a chimpanzee? To be honest with you, I wouldn't be at all surprised that if you were to do an in vitro fertilization, a test tube baby thing, with, let's say, a chimpanzee egg and a human sperm, and implant that into a chimpanzee surrogate mother, I would not be at all surprised to see it succeed. There were rumors around last year or the year before of somebody who'd actually done that. There was some very smart chimpanzee who was claimed to have a human male father. That turned out to be a hype and nonsense. But my guess would be, given 99% gene sharing, I wouldn't be at all surprised that one wouldn't have to get over one's natural repulsion at doing it naturally with a chimpanzee. You could do it. You could do it in a test tube. It would seem to be not impossible. You could make a hybrid. That would, of course, be illegal and unethical, and nobody would do it. But it's a temptation.
Well, is it unethical to engage in the genetic engineering that's being done in this country, for instance, with regard to creating soybeans that are resistant to chemicals that would kill weeds out in the soybean field?
Oh, I think we're in a different ballpark there. I mean, I don't believe, that soybeans have got a soul. I do believe, in some general sense, that humans have got a soul. So I think we have to apply a totally different set of ethics to humans than to any other creature. Chimpanzees share 99% of our genes, but they're not 99% human. They're not human at all. They're chimpanzees. It's worth remembering that bananas share a bit less than 50% of our genes. And, a banana isn't 50% human. It's a banana. So I don't see any great ethical issues with messing with the genes of soybeans or potatoes or cotton, of the kind which we're also familiar with. I do, on the other hand, see that there may well be practical issues, practical difficulties, of the kinds we've seen when we've messed with the living world before, with insecticides, say, or with antibiotics. Now, this may well be a problem, but I don't see it myself as an ethical problem.
Last time we were talking, we discussed the concept of genetics controlling behavior and, to some extent, intelligence.
Yes, that could well be true. Variation in intelligence, yes.
What's your feeling on the concept of genetic evolution controlling intelligence to such a way that we're now involved in what we've just been talking about, genetic engineering, and the ability to engineer a new species?
Well, I think, you know, we are the intelligent primate. I mean, in terms, if you compare ourselves with other primates, chimpanzees or gorillas, let's say, in terms of our body size relative to them, our brain is about 5 times bigger than it ought to be. So that's a big, big difference. We're a lot smarter than these other guys, thank God. But the interesting thing is, if you go back to the origin, the very beginnings of modern humans, something like 150,000 or so years ago, our brain hasn't got any bigger since then. It seemed to reach a plateau, a sort of crucial point of brain size, which has since then more or less stalled. And what I always believe, and I think is really quite a lot of evidence for it, is that that marked a complete switch in human evolution, because the arena of our own evolution, which gave rise to our own intelligence and our ability to really to take control of the rest of the world, the arena of human evolution moved into a new and unique area. It moved from body to mind. We are the only species, most of whose evolution has taken place in the brain, not in the body, not in the DNA. If you look at the human family tree, the DNA, which unites us to chimpanzees and so on, which it most definitely does, you can kind of make a big extended family of us. And we sit there very neatly, very close to the chimps and the gorillas, and that's fine for an evolutionist. But if you look at it more carefully, it turns out that we're unique among all the primates in our genes.
How do you mean? How are we unique?
Because we're the species that didn't evolve. If you look at the genetic difference, let's say, between two very different, distinct human groups, let's say, for example, Australian Aboriginals and Native Americans, who are on the opposite ends of the world, the difference in the DNA between those two groups is smaller than the difference between a typical pair of chimpanzee tribes or societies living 30 or 40 miles apart in the West African jungle. Our genes have not changed as we filmed the world. And I think that's because they didn't need to change. We evolve in our brains. We change our environment through our own intelligence, whereas other creatures have no choice but to evolve in their bodies.
So what can we learn from the fact that we have evolved in our brains?
Well, I think that we are, you know, evolution in some ways makes, to me, the creationist case. Why do they bother to come up with this irrational stuff about the Old Testament? What the creationists want to believe is that we are different. And evolution, Darwinism, tells us that in the important sense, which is what makes us human, we are different, we're unique. We're the only animal that evolves in our minds. Now that, to me, is in some ways an almost theological statement. And the Pope himself has come up quite recently with something not dissimilar by suggesting that at some time, at the origin of modern humans, a long time in the past, there was the insertion by divine means of something called the soul, which doesn't have any genes and doesn't leave any fossils. And if you cut somebody up, you can't find something that's called the soul. Now, I wouldn't use that language, but I would suggest that the idea of language and the brain being large enough to inform other brains what's happening and to understand the past and predict the future is what makes us different from every other primate. So I don't see any great conflict here.
How would you characterize that difference of the soul versus primates that don't have a soul?
Well, I mean, I'm no more or less qualified to comment on that than anybody else.
Because considered it.
That's not a scientific question. Now, I myself, as a scientist, don't believe in the existence of a physical soul. But if you're having that kind of argument, and people do, you're basically arguing in two fields at once. I often think that the arguments of religion and the arguments of science are both very powerful arguments. But they're rather like, religion and science are rather like a shark and a tiger. On their own territory, they're fantastically potent and aggressive beasts. But if they stray into the other one's territory, they always lose. Now, historically, what's tended to happen, and is happening again in the US, is that religion, or fundamental religion, is trying to stray into science's territory. and say, you can't say this is true because the Bible disagrees, well, it's going to lose. It always loses. It always has lost. Equivalently, if science, and it's tried this, if it tries to stray into religion's territory and says we can disprove the existence of God, it can't, or the existence of the soul, it can't. It's bound to lose. These are not physical ideas, they're metaphysical ideas. So I don't see any necessary conflict between the two. Science can tell us everything about ourselves apart from the interesting stuff.
I'd like to take a moment and say that our guest this week is Steve Jones. He is a professor of genetics at University College in London and the author of a recent book entitled Darwin's Ghost, The Origin of the Species Updated. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. You've talked about and you've written about the importance of tracing the Y chromosome.
Yes, I mean, I said a moment ago that we were the primate that didn't evolve, and that's true. But of course, we've evolved a bit. If you look across the surface of the world, you can see that people look different. Now, we pay a lot of attention to looks, and it's noticeable that we differ in skin color. That only varies, and that's only a few genes difference. And what's embarrassing to admit is we don't know why. There are lots of interesting ideas, but they haven't really been proved why there are black people in the tropics and white people away from the tropics. We don't know why that is. But we've evolved to some extent, and that's a genetic change. Now, what we can do now is to begin to look at the DNA, not just the stuff on the surface, but to get deep into the cells and the lineages and ask more about human evolution. And one of the things I'm interested in, and people in my research group are interested in, you know, as I gather from my deep and husky voice, I'm actually a male. And males have one particular chromosome which retraces the history of men. It's the Y chromosome. It's passed on a bit like surnames from fathers to sons and then on to grandsons. So it contains the history of Adam in some ways. Now the Y chromosome, like all others, has quite a lot of variation in it, so you can look at Y chromosomes and you can make statements about who's related in the paternal line to who else. And it's all really very interesting. Many of you may have heard of some work that was done by people, some of the people in my own group, which studied the Y chromosome of one cultural group who had always believed themselves to be descended from a particular set of males. And these were the Kohanim, the Jewish people with the surname Cohen, who've always thought that they were the descendants of the priests of the temple. And as you will know, at the fall of the temple in AD 70, the priesthood was overtaken by the rabbinate. But the people who descended from the priests, the Kohens, always thought, well, we've stayed father to son for 2,000 years. Nobody else has got in here. And everybody else has always thought, well, that's a nice legend, but it's a legend. Nobody could keep the other males out of the family for 2,000 years. Look at the Y chromosomes, and the answer is, yep, yes, they did. Nearly all Cohens have got the identical or very similar Y chromosome, which descended from probably 2,000 years ago without many other people getting in. And that turns out to be quite widespread. Now, the amazing spin on the Cohen story is that if you go to Southern Africa, there's a group there of Africans called the Lemba, and I've been out there and I've spoken with them and I've actually taken blood specimens or other kinds of specimens from them, and they've always believed themselves to be of Jewish origin. That seems a completely crazy idea because they're black Africans. They have always been traders. They've always, nowadays, are the doctors and the lawyers of Southern Africa. They've always stayed scattered among other tribes. So maybe they picked up this Jewish notion when the Christian missionaries first appeared. But, amazingly, and I still find it hard to comprehend, these Lemba, many of them, have this Cohen Y chromosome that otherwise is only found in Israel. So maybe there is a Jewish tie there. I think it's quite a recent one, probably. But it's there somewhere, and we wouldn't have known that without the Y chromosome.
How is the Y chromosome traced?
Well, you simply get, I've just come back, actually, a few weeks ago, I came back from Syria, and you go to Syria, and in Syria, it's very easy. There's none of this question of informed consent. The Syrian government gives you a nice big policeman with a gun, and you go to a village, and the policeman says in Arabic, you guys spit into this tube, and they each want to spit into a tube, and you bring it back home. And the Y chromosome it's really like a surname. It's got variant sites on it, and it's passed on effectively asexually because it's only passed from fathers to sons, so it's not reshuffled every generation like other genes. And And you can use it as a surname. And you can see what variants you possess. I myself have got a Y chromosome, which is only found, as far as we know, and these are early days yet, it's only found on the farthest fringes of Western Europe. It's found in Wales, and I'm Welsh. I was born a Welsh speaker, indeed, in West Wales. And it's also found in the Basque country in northern, northwestern Spain.
How do you account for the separation there?
Well, it looks like, and these are early days, but the Basques, as many people know, speak a language which is totally different from any other language in the world. It may have some affinities with the languages of Soviet Georgia, possibly. But it's not like French or German or English or even Sanskrit. It's way out there. It's different. And it may well be a pre-agricultural language, a language before the farmers. And the farmers, when they came to the western fringes of Europe 5,000 or so years ago, they never conquered the Basques. The Basques said, get lost. We're up here in our mountains. We don't want to enter in this newfangled stuff. We're going to stay the way we are. And they did. And they kept their languages. And now we know they kept their pre-farming Y chromosomes too. The Welsh, though, the Welsh have always thought themselves to be Celts. It's not quite clear what that means. But they've always thought, oh, we've got our own Celtic language. But what almost certainly happened is we were there. We stuck with it. We had this pre-agricultural Y chromosome. But in the end, we gave in as the Welsh. We learned the Celtic language. We adapted that. And that's a farming language. But we kept our Y chromosomes. So that's what ties us with the pre-agricultural people 1,000 miles to the south. We're on the fringes of Europe. We lost our language but kept our chromosomes. The Basques kept them both. So we've traced with these Jewish Y chromosomes, we've traced this historical event back 2,000 years or so. And that's kind of, you know, interesting and surprising. Well, very recently, in the last week or so, there's been a scientific paper which is in many ways much more interesting and surprising, which looks at the Y chromosomes of Native Americans, North American and South American Indians, as they're loosely called. It turns out that nearly all Native Americans have, just like the Kaanem, a very, very small subset of Y chromosomes, just a few of them, which suggests they all come from a very few male ancestors, possibly just one or two, or three men who founded all the lineages in all the hundreds of thousands or millions of Native Americans that there now are. Now, so there was a little small nucleus of males who got across. Now, even more amazingly, it turns out that this Native American Y chromosome is now found only in a little tiny and almost extinct people called the Kets, not the Celts, but the Kets, who lived to the south of Lake Baikal in Russia. So this may well be where the Native Americans first came from. They were a southern Siberian tribe, but for reasons we don't realize, we don't understand, moved up into the north of Siberia, moved across the Bering Land Bridge, just a very few of them, and filled an entire continent. So the legacy of these Ket people, of whom we know almost nothing, who've almost gone, I think there's only about 6 Ket speakers left, is left with us all around us as we see the Native Americans. And that's something else which you wouldn't have known without genetics.
And the genetics show us what picture? What do we see under an electron microscope when we're looking at these chromosomes?
Well, it depends how powerful your microscope is. I mean, if you look at human chromosomes.
When you're looking, what do you see?
Well, if you look at a modern setup, what you do is you can actually paint, as we say, chromosomes with different dyes. So you can actually see very bright colors on different chromosomes. You can even, if you do it very cunningly, pick out individual genes as little bright spots on the chromosome. So you can map genes in that way. If you rack up your magnification a lot and do some nasty stuff to the chromosome, you can actually see the DNA itself as a double helix.
I'd like to take a moment and say that our guest this week is Steve Jones. He is a professor of genetics at University College in London and the author of a recent book entitled Darwin's Ghost, The Origin of the Species Updated. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Steve, you've been to America many times, and now you're here promoting your book, Darwin's Ghost. Do you have some observations of the United States that you could share with us?
Well, I think the cars have got bigger again. They got smaller for a while, now they got bigger. America is American, always will be, I guess. My wife is an American, so I come back and forth a lot, so I'm a kind of mid-Atlantic man here. One thing I've noticed, and it's a kind of cruel thing to say, but it's true, and every American is aware of it, and it's got a kind of important message for genetics, really, is that, as everybody knows in this country, there is now a plague of obesity in America, and that's very striking to a European. It's happening in Europe, but much more slowly. And it's particularly prevalent among Native Americans, and also to a lesser extent among African Americans. And we now understand an awful lot about why it's there.
Why is that?
It has a message for those who think that the answer lies in the genes. Because certainly among Native Americans, to a lesser extent among African Americans, these people have got genes which were very good and evolved through natural selection to deal with an economy in which starvation alternated with glut. You either had too little food or too much. And if you had too much, your entire system had evolved to arrange to deposit that, to store it, and to last you through the next lean period. Now, of course, in America, not just in America, but all over the developed world, we're in a phase of continual excess, of continual glut. But those people who've evolved with Native American ancestors or African American ancestors, although their diet is not very different from that of European Americans, their genes predispose them to this terrible problem of overweight and type 2 diabetes and so on. So much so that type 2 diabetes, that's the non-insulin dependent type, is sometimes actually called New World Syndrome, because your chances of getting it are defined by how many Native American ancestors you have. But this New World Syndrome only came to the New World with this modern hamburger-based diet. So the question whether that's this obesity and this illness, and it's a severe illness, is genetic or environmental is meaningless. It's both. And that's really, to me, is the take-home lesson of genetics. It's one people often forget. If you're a geneticist, you become a profound environmentalist. You realize how important the environment is. You're not driven by your genes. Your genes tell you what environment is safe for you, what environment is best for you. And that's the most important message of the DNA to me. And that's the one, really, which you see perhaps more clear than anywhere else in this country.
However, if the genes say what environment is most important, then we're really looking at many, many generations for the environment to, in effect, control the genes and give a situation or an environment in which the better fit will adapt.
That's true. And I think, you know, as I said, I think as humans, we've moved beyond that necessity. I mean, I can illustrate the interaction between gene and environment with a rather nasty phrase, but it's true, which is that if everybody smoked, lung cancer would be a genetic disease. And that's true, because in order to get lung cancer, to simplify the story, you have to have two things. First of all, you have to have a slightly weakened form of one particular gene, a damaged form of a kind of DNA repair gene. And if you smoke, then you're sunk. You're going to get lung cancer. End of story. No questions about it. Now, if everybody smoked in 1,000 years' time, that variant form of the gene would have been done away with by natural selection, and lung cancer might perhaps no longer be a problem. Lots of people would have died in order to get to there. But we're going to deal with lung cancer not by waiting for evolution, natural selection to do the job. We're going to deal with lung cancer by banning cigarettes. Now, maybe in the land of the free you won't ban cigarettes, but you'll persuade people that cigarettes are lethal. I myself would like to take the CEOs of all the cigarette companies and hang them from the nearest lynching tree myself. That would be my move on it, but I guess that's against the law. But we're going to cure this problem not by waiting for our genes to evolve, but using our minds to change our environments. And that's a statement, really, about what genetics tells us, that it's we can now control our own genetic destiny, and that we're the only animal that can say that.
Well, Steve Jones, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious. And again, before we close, I'd like to ask you to tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately.
Oh, hell, I'm going to have to think about another one there just for a minute. I picked up and bought a book the other week in a bookstore, which had a most unpromising title. It was called The Book of Pi, Pi the Greek symbol, you know, the one which is relates the radius of a circle to its area. And it's prints out, it's 3.14 and so on, and millions of letters, and it's kind of history of pi. And it's got a nice little story there which I hadn't known, which is most amusing, which is that in the 1890s, the state of Indiana tried to pass a law which said that said that instead of this number pi being 3.141, etc., 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 into infinity, it was in fact 3, because that would be much more convenient for the road surveyors and so on in the state of Indiana. And so this went to the Highways Committee because it was involved with road surveyors. Then fortunately it was quashed, because of course, if the state of Indiana did define the state of the figure pi to be 3, and if nature took any notice, which I would doubt that it would, the state of Indiana would then presumably just cease to exist. The laws of physics would stop working. The universe would come to an end. At least Indiana would come to an end. And I found that a very amusing story. It's a bit like the Kansas, famous Kansas attempt to ban evolution from schools, you know. You can pass as many laws as you like, but they're human laws. Nature is out there. Nature doesn't care. And that's kind of an important message I got from that book.
Which is kind of interesting, because we create these laws and pass them on by using words and language to describe the images or the concepts as we see them, but the laws of nature continue to exist.
That's right. I find it oddly, you know, lots of people tend to say, doesn't it feel you make you feel naked and afraid to know that you are a temporary inhabitant, the species is a temporary inhabitant on this tiny, insignificant planet, on a minor galaxy, on the outer edges of the Milky Way, which is one of the small parts of the entire universe. I tend to think, so what? I like to feel insignificant. I don't like to feel at the center of things. I like to be just part of a much bigger whole. And in some ways, that's what evolution does for the living world. And it's what science does for the world as a whole. I find it comforting to know that if the human species had never existed, the laws of physics would still be out there.
And it's nice to be here. And it's nice to have you with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Steve Jones.
Professor Steve Jones is the author of Darwin's Ghost, The Origin of the Species Updated. The book that he recommends is The Book of Pi. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.